Committee on Smart Growth and Commerce did a really good job of doing a section-by-section analysis of the bill, and I've just summarized that for you on a piece of paper here with going through section-by-section. I'm not going to go through it all, but just realize that it is, it has no substantive changes in the sense of revenue aspects. Those have all been removed from the bill. It is reorganizing the enterprise zone statute and really making it easier to read, moving things to topical sections like the creation of the zone, and all that language got moved to one section, and termination of zones and management of the enterprise zones and duties of the administrators and eligible business firms. So it does a much better job now of being able to read on different topics and being able to use the enterprise zone statutes. So that's what the A in Growth Bill does. And then you do have a dash A4, which is an Indian Reservation Enterprise Zone Amendment. And what this is designed to do is help stimulate investment in Indian reservations. And I'll just go through some of the key parts of that amendment. And first, in the section 34B, it's defining what tribal government and tribal tax is. The tribal government is the governing body of an Indian tribe. The tribal tax is the tax that is levied by a tribal government upon a business. And this could be a property type tax, it could be an income type tax, business activities type tax. It is allowing businesses that are engaged in the manufacture of business products or services to other businesses or to the general public. And this makes it a little different than typical enterprise zone eligible businesses, is it doesn't have to be business to business production, it could be to the general public. Those businesses have to be within an enterprise zone to be eligible as an eligible business. The business facility must be located on reservation enterprise zone. And it defines new business facilities. So this enterprise zone would only allow this tax credit for the new business facilities that come into the reservation after January 1st of 2002. In section 34C of the amendment is just a policy statement. And then with 34D, it's outlining the requirements that an Indian reservation must meet. So to be eligible as an Indian reservation, you have to be a federally recognized Indian tribe. The reservation is all within the state of Oregon. There are criteria here which restrict this Indian reservation to have a population density that cannot exceed 15 persons per square mile as of January 1st, 2002, and 50% or more of the households within the reservation have incomes below 80% of the median income of this state. And also there has to be an unemployment rate within the reservation that's 2% greater than the state average unemployment rate. So those are criteria that are needed for each of the Indian reservations to qualify as an Indian reservation enterprise zone. Economic Community Development Department is the department that is going to be determining whether these enterprise zones are going to be designated. And then in section 34E, what this is doing is this is the language that's providing the income or corporate tax credit. And the tax credit is for the businesses that go into the Indian enterprise zone. So for those businesses, they can have taxes against for their taxes that they have to pay to the state of Oregon in the reservation zone. And the amount of the credit, and the only thing that's limiting the amount of the credit is the amount of tribal taxes then that this new business is going to be paying to the tribe. So it's that tribal tax that becomes the amount of the credit then that the business can use on their income tax or corporate taxes. And the credit amount cannot exceed the tax liability of the eligible business in a year. And then in section 34F and G, that is clarifying that a reservation enterprise zone shall be a non-urban enterprise zone. That's the classification, it'll be non-urban. But these zones, these reservation zones, will not be considered in the total number of non-urban enterprise zones that are allowed in the state. So that's important characteristics of these. These are not limited. There's not a limit on the number of reservation enterprise zones, but it's not also taking away from the number of non-urban enterprise zones that economic and community development can cite in the state. It applies to tax years beginning 2002-03, and And in the last two sections are just amending tax laws to allow this credit for businesses. So I don't have a revenue impact on this. I think we'll get more additional information from the testimony today. But again, this amendment is targeted to certain Indian reservations, and at this time, I think it's just targeted towards Warm Springs and Umatilla Indian reservations.
Okay, thank you. Are we in work session or public hearing right now?
It's work session for this bill, but
we have people who have signed up to testify. So Mike Burton, would you want to come up from Economic Development? John, you're going to come up with him? Okay.
Chair Carlson, members of the committee, I'm Mike Burton, the Assistant Director of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. With me is John Phillips, and hopefully Michelle Deister will also come to the table because we're all in this together.
Michelle didn't sign up here.
No, we're still all in this together.
She volunteered.
Staff did a good job of describing what the bill does now. I'd just like to give you a little bit more background and and we'll move on. Part of the background is this bill was directed by a budget note in the last session and was at one point a vehicle for some fairly aggressive streamlining. That streamlining was not intended by our department to have revenue impacts, but our partners pointed out to us that some what we thought were nominal impacts might instead be significant. So the bill you have before you now, the A engrossed versions, has been significantly modified from the bill the department originally presented. We still support the bill. We think it's an important bill, and as staff described, it does some important things. It reorders the bill in a manner that makes sense in terms of following through from the creation of the zone to the end of the zone. Orders those things chronologically. Dexter Johnson deserves commendation for that work. Additionally, it moves some of the burden off of Department of Revenue and the county assessors, who really don't volunteer for that burden, and puts it on the involved parties who do volunteer for that, the sponsors of the bill, or the zones, our department, and the businesses themselves. For those reasons, the department continues to support the bill and joined with our partners in that effort. I'd like to give you a short description of enterprise zones and what they're about. I think it's relevant for the general discussion, but I think make a couple comments on the A4 amendments, which I just received. An enterprise zone is a locally determined economic development incentive program targeted toward distressed areas. Part of the selection criteria are relative economic hardship or status of a community, and the zone is one meaningful tool that at local election has limited by statute to 47 zones, can be brought to bear on the potential for economic development. What it does is it forgives property taxes on qualified new investment for 3 years, and if the company pays well enough, better than the county median income or median wage, that three-year exemption can be negotiated to extend to 4 or 5 years. Again, that's a local option. It's negotiable. The three-year, once a zone's been established, if the business qualifies and goes through the appropriate application steps, isn't automatic. And with that, I think I would move on to just a couple of observations related to a quick reading of the proposed amendments for the Indian Reservation Zone. As I said, I haven't had time to really look at this, and I'm really not in a position to make comments. We would support the concept of incenting development in some of the most distressed areas of the states, which are represented by these zones. We don't know the details of how this works. I did observe in reading through it that the exemption is broader. It goes to a place that it allows for a wider range of business activities than the current program, which is focused on primarily manufacturing and wholesale activities. This is much broader than that. It also gets into income tax, which is not part of the normal enterprise zone exemption. not prepared to comment on those because the purpose is a different end. In addition to the incentive purpose, there's also apparently an issue of double taxation in that tribal governments may levy taxes and then their state and federal taxes. So this would try to deal with that, and I'm not prepared to speak to that. But I would be available to answer questions. I would yield the microphone at this time to either of my partners.
John, why don't you go ahead? Michelle, did you want
to? Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michelle Dyster, League of Oregon Cities. I don't really have anything to add to Mr. Burton's comments, just that we appreciate their working together with us to kind of bring the scope back down to the potential revenue impacts that the changes would have had. And we now have, as amended, a bill that I think everybody pretty much supports.
Thank you, Dan. Have you seen the dash four amendments?
Madam Chair, I glanced at them briefly, and I don't believe that they would affect cities at all, seeing as, you know, the reservations from where the county would be in, more in county jurisdictions as opposed to municipal city jurisdictions. So I don't think we're affected.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. We did get a copy of this draft bill, 2131, back in December and worked with the Department of Economic Development to review it for substantive changes. And we think that it's void of that right now. And it does really an important thing, though, in that it does reorganize the very, very confusing statutes. It's laborious for potential businesses to read through and try to comply with and for us to administer. So we think this is a good piece of legislation as the bill is engrossed before you. And also, we just saw the LC-4s today for the first time, so we will reserve our comments on that, both from an income and a property tax side.
Thank you. I had a question for Elizabeth, and I think you alluded to this. You said that you didn't have a revenue impact statement on this at this time, that you were requesting information, or was it just on the dashboards that you didn't have this?
Madam Chairman, with the A and Gross bill as it is,
There's not a revenue impact. But the dashboards would have some sort of an undetermined revenue impact.
Yeah, it'll be a state revenue impact.
Okay, great. All right, any other questions? Representative Bates.
I was down there first. I'm wondering on the possible financial impact. The way I read the dash fours very quickly, this is just affects tribal revenue, tribal taxes. Is there some way that would affect state taxes?
Madam Chairman and Representative Bates, it's because the tax credit is on their income state, the businesses that go into the reservation. They're the ones who get the tax credit for the amount of tax that they have paid to the Indian tribes. So they get it as a credit on their income tax or corporate tax, Oregon State income or corporate tax.
Want to follow up?
Yes, Madam Chair.
You look like you wanted to follow up.
Like, if they're being exempt from tribal taxes, and I'm reading the dashboards wrong, then
yes,
I'll go back to them again.
Yes.
I'll reread it.
Chairman and Representative Bates, it's not an exemption from the tribal taxes. They pay the tribal taxes, but then they get a credit for that amount on their income or corporate tax.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Okay, I think Representative Ross is next. Representative, did you have a...
Yeah, I was wondering if your history if you can tell me how some of these businesses have done. In other words, after their exemption expires, what's the history of staying and growing, or do some just leave after that?
Chair Carlson, Representative Haas. I actually attached, I should have explained the handout. I have my testimony. I have a short summary of the Enterprise Zone program. The booklet is a long description of the Enterprise Zone program. But there's a schedule on the back of the Staple Together handouts that details the activity in enterprise zones during the 2000 tax year. Our experience is that most of the businesses stay well beyond the exemption. The risky period in a business life for new businesses in the first several years, by the time someone has used the enterprise zone exemption, they're pretty much solid, viable, and typically stay in the zone.
Follow up. So you're saying that you don't have or very limited people who would just go in, take advantage of this tax break, and leave?
Chair Carlson, Representative Haas, yes, it's very rare. Specifically, I think, because an exemption applies to real property and other fixed assets, but it's capital investment that earns a zone. That's exemption, and those investments stay on the site, so that firms typically do not leave the site.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. It's just tricky business for all of us, all of these tax breaks. How to know when someone should receive an exemption or a tax break if they would not have done this? In other words, where's the line? Do you know, do you have an answer to how correctly we're drawing the line? Give somebody a tax break that they may, that, you know, may have resulted in them locating there anyway, with or without the tax break.
Chair Carlson, Representative Haas, there's no way of knowing, in most cases, absolutely for sure, whether or not the enterprise zone was the sole determinant. It's our experience that most of the benefiting businesses, in terms of number but not value of exemption, are small businesses that already exist in the community. The real targets of this are recruitment prospects, and a number of those tell us that but for the enterprise zone exemption, they would not be there. Often, we have undertaken to do an assessment of costs of doing business at an Oregon site relative to an out-of-state site, and the enterprise zone, because it's very front-end loaded, the exemption comes off of the first several years of location of a business or expansion of a business. Because of that, and in what is called present value determinations, they tend to be fairly heavily weighted, and you can get a numerical evaluation of the impact. Based on that, you can compare this site versus that site, and there are times when that makes a significant difference, and the company will tell us that's why we're locating on this site in Oregon. But you really can't know for sure.
Representative Witt?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Anyone else have questions? Representative Beck?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I understand this chart that you were just talking about. Estimated cost of exempted property in millions. What is that? Is that the value of the improvement or the amount of money they put in to create the improvement, or what is it?
Chair Carlson, Representative Beck, it is the amount invested, the amount that they put into the assets that are being exempted.
So it doesn't, you conceivably could tell us how much value each of these, the property tax values created by each of these investments. Somebody could probably calculate that.
Carlson, Representative, I believe the Department of Revenue or the assessor
would know that.
It would actually do that.
And their exemption is it a property tax exemption?
Chair Carlson, Representative, yes, it's only a property tax exemption. And that's one of the differences between the Dash 4 amendments and the current enterprise zone.
So do we know, Madam Chair, do you know roughly how much property tax value is exempted as a result of this program currently?
Chair Carlson, Representative X, I did a very quick and dirty $15 per thousand estimate of that and came up with something like $10 million, or $15 million, excuse me.
$10 million of value or $10 million of income loss?
Exempted property tax. It's quick and dirty, and
That's law. That's revenue, mm-hmm. not value.
Right.
It's not assessed value. Okay.
Chair Carlson, Representative Beck, the total estimated investment was $2.2
billion. Okay. Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. That's what I need. Thank you.
Go ahead, Michelle.
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Beck, at least for cities and counties, this is a local option. So it's only the communities that ask, mm-hmm. To be included in the program.
Sure.
We see this as a viable economic development tool for those communities that are in distress.
That leads me to another question.
Representative?
Do school districts have a say in whether these properties are exempted from their school tax?
Chair Chair Carlson, Representative Beck. As of the last session, the department adopted rules that requires any jurisdictions applying for zone status to conference with all taxing districts within the zone. So school districts are at least consulted.
Okay.
Thank you. I had just one question. I noticed, looking at your book and looking at your chart, and there are 17 currently exempted business firms in Salem. And then I looked in here, and so the sponsor's the City of Salem. Do you have any sense, can you give me an example of one or two of those 17 businesses in Salem, or get me a list later on? I just want to get a sense of what kinds of businesses, I think it's sort of a follow-up to this earlier question that I heard, are taking advantage of this.
Chair Carlson, my actual applied experience was just south in Lincoln and Lynn counties, and I can tell you some sites there, but we can get you the information for Salem.
That'd be great. Thank you. No questions? Thank you very much. I think there are three folks here, it looks like, from Warm Springs, but if you'd like to come up together, Charles Jackson, Almy, Pat?
Almy Pat.
All right, and Michael Mason. Now that you can speak to the Dash 4 amendments.
Okay.
Whoever would like to start.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Olney Pat Jr. I'm the chairman of the Tribal Council of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. several years ago, the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs made a decision to cut back on our primary source of revenue, which was timber. We went from approximately 110 million board feet annual harvest and have scaled that back to about 45 million board feet per year. That transition has caused a great deal of hardship on the reservation. That, coupled with poor market conditions, as I'm sure you're probably aware, has caused some hardship with our employment picture. We've recently cut back about 60 jobs on the in our local mill, taking out one complete shift. During last year, we had been in contact with an aerospace firm, or a couple of aerospace firms actually, one to produce components for a composite, a type certified, FAA type certified composite aircraft, and also had been in contact with a larger defense contractor to produce composite parts. However, there was some uncertainty about what the tax picture would look like, and we feel like this would clear the way for some of the take away some of that uncertainty so that we can attract such businesses in the future. Now, we haven't totally ruled out doing something like that again in the future, but these are windows of opportunity, and they're very easy to miss. These businesses are doing this not so much out of the kindness of their heart, but because they have a requirement to use some certain amount of minority-owned businesses within their government contracts. So they found that they fill that requirement elsewhere. Anyway, that kind of gives you just a little brief overview over the past several years as to what our situation is in Warm Springs, and Charles Jackson will provide more details.
Thank you. My name is Charles Jackson. I'm the Tribe Secretary Treasurer, and I work for the Tribal Council. For the past 10 years or so, we've been actively seeking to diversify our economy away from natural resources based primarily timber, as the chairman suggested, and away from a dominance of governmental activity, governmental jobs. We have about 1,300 full-time jobs within the reservation area, about 1,000 square miles, and about 700 of those jobs are tribal government jobs. So as the chairman mentioned, we are finding it harder and harder to support existing governmental employment and needing to find a way to attract outside business investors to help us to develop the private sector, the non-governmental jobs and economy. As the chairman suggested, we've tried several times to do that in the past and have run up against this uncertainty about the taxation situation that would be faced by the outside investor. It appears that the outside investor in coming onto the reservation would be subject to a state property and income taxation based on the in value of their investment and also the operations and the revenue and profitability of their reservation operations, and so would be faced with paying taxes like everybody else does. Difficulty that provides for us is that the tribe, are the ones that provide all of the local services within the reservation. Police, fire, ambulance, water, sewer, sanitation, and so forth, with the one major exception being we are part of the local public school district, 509J in Jefferson County. Most of the rest of the services are provided by the tribe, and we have to fund those services from the sale of our timber or partially from the power generation activities that we have. Well, if we, the tribe, are going to continue to provide adequate services to an investor investing in plant and equipment within the reservation boundary, how are we going to pay for those services in the case of shrinking revenue? Well, we would look naturally towards creating our own tax base, which is something local governments do. But if we were to create a property tax or an income tax for that investor, for that business, that would create a dual taxation situation. And that would, rather than be able to attract a new investor, it would be a tremendous disincentive. And that's run a couple of potential investors off, quite frankly, in the last couple of years. It's been very frustrating. So to address this situation, some of the things that we are doing ourselves, we've just created a new development corporation, the Tribal Council has, and we're going to go out, getting ready to go out and actively recruit, again, local, or not local, but new businesses and new business investment on the reservation. And this bill would enable us to tell them for sure that there's basically a level playing field. If you invest on the reservation or off reservation, you would either pay taxes to the state, you're investing in your business and equipment off the reservation, state or local taxes, or if you're investing on the reservation where the services would be provided by the tribal government, then you would pay taxes to help support those services to the tribal government. But you would not, they would not be faced with a dual taxation situation.
Thank you. Mr. Mason?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I just want to emphasize that, you know, as Mr. Jackson has mentioned, I should say Michael Mason, I lobby for the Warm Springs Tribes here in Salem, live in Oregon City. But the you know, it's important to note, I think, that the services that are being provided by the tribe are truly tribally provided services. There are no federal funding here, and it's not a federal pass-through that's going on. So there really is a squeeze on the tribe when they try to extend those services to protect, you know, non-Indian investment on the reservation. I also emphasize that what we're talking about is really tax fairness here. The state income tax is assessed, but it doesn't go to pay for any services on the reservation. Those services, again, are all provided by the tribe. So I think, you know, there's been some effort to carefully draft this so that it's not overbroad, so that it certainly doesn't affect any existing business and have an impact. Of course, we're not sure what the impact might be on revenue, but it certainly has none now. And we'd be happy to answer any questions. We very much appreciate the committee looking at this. This is something that the tribes have been considering and kind of struggling with for several years, and just hope that it's the right time for action by the legislature to help them with their efforts at self-sufficiency. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the Warm Springs panel? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, does this would this credit against Oregon income taxes apply to all kinds of taxes that might be assessed by the tribes? Or just to, I mean, does it apply to property taxes, income taxes, excise taxes? Does it, would it be applicable to any kind of a tax?
I'm sure I want to answer that.
Yeah, if we could invite an attorney for the tribe, Jim Noteboom, to the podium, and I can retire faced with the difficulty of the question.
I'm Jim Noteboom, a tribal attorney. We tried to address it so that it had to be a like tax. A property tax could be credited against a property tax, an income tax against another income tax, but they could not be mixed because property taxes go to the local government, and it wouldn't be fair to credit against an income tax that went to a different entity.
Can you follow up, Madam Chair? Can you tell me where that is in the Dash 4 amendments?
Okay. No. And the reason I'm looking here is that we had submitted a concept earlier that included that. Yes, I think it's over on page 4. Section 34E.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Chapters 316, 317, and 318 apply specifically to income taxes, isn't that true? And corporate excise taxes, not to other kinds of taxes.
Right.
So, I mean, is there another provision in here relating to other kinds of taxes that might be levied by a tribe upon businesses?
Okay, what has happened here is that when legislative council put the bill together, and this is the first I've actually seen of the actual bill language, they made some changes from what we had submitted, and we had included a definition of a category of taxes. No, that's not it. Yeah, no, that's not the provision. We had included a concept in the draft proposal that in which we defined a category of tax, and we said that was a specific type of tax that was levied, whether it was income or a real property tax or whatever. And the credit would only be allowed for like types of taxes.
The language here seems to speak just to income taxes.
Right. And the intent, again, of the concept we had was that if the tribe levies a particular type of tax, whether it's a real property tax, personal property tax, or income tax, that could be used as a credit against a like tax on the state side.
Mm-hmm.
And you could not have shifting between the taxes.
Mm-hmm. Hold on, Andrew. Well, what types of taxes are currently levied by tribes on businesses?
The tribal council at Warm Springs has passed a number of years ago, and in fact it's been there for a long time, a taxing ordinance, and it's used primarily for business regulation as opposed to revenue generation. And there is very little tax revenue gained by the tribe at this point. In fact, what typically happens when we deal with an off-reservation business that may locate is that in order to do that in the past, the tribe has had to, in essence, waive its taxing authority. And, for example, we've done that with Portland General Electric Company. The tribes have waived their tax authority because PGE is already paying taxes on that project. And in the legislation, we recognize that it would be too disruptive to change the status quo with regard to existing businesses. But for new businesses, we think it really is appropriate that if the tribe levies the tax to provide these services, and they do spend millions of dollars every year of tribal funds providing these services, that they ought to be able to tax these businesses.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Do tribes currently impose property taxes on property within the tribal territory?
Not at Warren County, no.
They do not?
No.
Do they have the authority to do that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Very clearly have the authority.
And what you would want to do in this bill is if the tribe imposed a property tax, well, I mean, the state can't impose it, the county can't impose a property tax, can they, on property inside a tribal
territory? Yes, they can.
They can.
It varies with particular businesses. It takes a complex legal analysis, but as a general rule, yes, they can. There are some exceptions where they cannot.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. What you want to be able to do is in any kind of a tax that the tribe would have, which it could impose, which it can legally impose upon a business, I guess it would be under tribal law, wouldn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that any corresponding tax relative to the county or the state of Oregon would be credited.
Right.
To the extent of the tax that the tribe would impose based upon its taxing authority as a sovereign entity.
Right. And it would not change the taxing system of the state. They would still have to file all the returns and do all the reporting requirements. There would simply be a line there which they would make a deduction or a credit for any tribal tax paid. And so the taxing system would remain as is in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was discussion, and Mr. Mason brought it up, that the services that are provided to the tribes are limited relative to services that are provided to non-tribal territory. What services, I mean, currently, how are services broken out where the tribes are providing those services directly in their territory and where the state is providing those services? The state of Oregon.
I think if we just go down sort of a laundry list, that, for example, police protection, fire protection, ambulance, the tribes provide all of that. There's no, basically, state service except on Highway 26 through the reservation. There, the state police do routine patrolling there. But the tribal ambulance and tribal police respond to accidents on Highway 26 and provide those services. Then if you take a look at services like the basic infrastructure, water, sewer, those types of things, tribes provide. The one area where there's an exception, I think, is in the area perhaps of school services, where the tribe is a part of the school district, but at the same time, there are federal impact funds, that sort of thing, that do flow to the school district because of the tribe.
And we have just entered into an agreement with the local school district to share in on a 50-50 basis the cost of construction of a new elementary school at Warm Springs.
When you really come down to it, the state of Oregon on the Warm Springs Reservation and the county provide very, very few services. The tribal government, for example, the law and order system, it's a tribal court. That's all handled by the tribe. And the tribe's revenues, for the most part, are those that it earns from its enterprises. And again, it doesn't have a tax base, so it takes enterprise revenues and pays those.
Madam Chair, this is a little confusing to me because it's sort of a different animal than we saw in commerce when we're talking about enterprise zones that are outside of a tribal boundary. If a company were to want to come into the Warm Springs Reservation as an example, would they at this point not pay state property taxes?
If they owned a real property that was taxable in the reservation, in all likelihood, they would pay state property taxes. Just as, for example, Portland General Electric Company pays state property taxes on the portion of the dams located on the reservation. So if, for example, a business came on and built a factory and owned the factory, then in that case, it's virtually certain they would pay state property tax. There's some limited exceptions the Supreme Court has carved out, for example, in the forestry area where they wouldn't pay taxes.
So this bill would eliminate for a period of time, as well as any other enterprise zone, that tax if the Warm Springs tribe decide that's the route they want to go.
The bill would really do two separate things. Okay, first, to the extent that the business pays a tax to the tribe, then that could be credited. We would like to perhaps at some point also make it clear, because our thinking was that the tribe should also be able to give the same sort of tax abatement types of benefits that could be off of the reservation, so that and it wouldn't be different from what the counties could do in an enterprise zone off the reservation, but if they wanted to abate the taxes, they could do that. And the reason that we're sort of thinking about that is that enterprise zones, one of the tools they fundamentally use to attract business is the tax abatement vehicle. And so why shouldn't that be available on the reservation?
Madam Chair, just to follow my train of thought, just to make sure I get this clear. So a company comes in, they are assessed taxes, property taxes, ad valorem taxes by the state,
right.
And the tribe doesn't get any benefit from that because they're taking care of their needs locally, which would normally be taken care of by a county, or they're taking care of their local needs themselves, either through tribal funds or federal funds or whatever source of revenue they have. And so your bill here says, well, we'll go ahead and levy a new tax on this and use that as an amount that will be taken off the property taxes paid to the state, and it levels the playing field. That's what you're really talking about.
Yes.
I'm sorry it takes so much time to understand it. Thank you.
I have a quick question. The state does not collect property taxes, but you're talking about taxes that are collected by the local government in the case of property tax.
Right, but they're authorized under state law, so we kind of refer to those as state taxes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why the requirement here that you not have more than, 15 persons per square mile? It sounds like it's an attempt just to include two tribes in the definition of the dash force.
We were really trying in when we included that to make it the equivalent of the rural enterprise zone, a non-urban enterprise zone, because fundamentally in Oregon you do have two different situations. You've got tribes basically in rural areas, and then you've got urban tribes like Cow Creek or Siletz, and they're just different situations. In addition to those situations, you really got a situation in which some reservations are very large, where the tribe is really providing virtually all of the services and is trying to differentiate between those two.
So in this case, you know, are you comfortable that, it sounds like this only includes two tribes when you use this definition. Does that bring in appropriately, in your opinion, those tribes that should get the benefit of this dash four amendment, or does it leave some out that should be considered within the purview of this legislation?
I think that's fundamentally a question for the legislature. I mean, this would be a state program, but at least what we're trying to do, and if you look at historically, if you go to Warm Springs, it's a community of about three to 4,000 people. And in terms of the commercial enterprise, other than the government, you have, I think, two restaurants, and you have a gas station, and that's about it. Everything else. So there really is almost no, you know, a community of 3,000 people doesn't have many of the most fundamental services or businesses on the reservation. It's just been, and it's not just the tax system. I mean, there are all sorts of impediments to sort of businesses locating on the reservation, and the tribe is trying to remove those impediments through a whole variety of programs, adoptions of commercial codes, and trying to make lands available, developing infrastructure. But the tax disincentive that exists right now is a significant one.
And sure, do we have any revenue impact, Elizabeth, do you know, on this? We haven't done one, I assume.
No, Madam Chair and Representative Witt, no, I haven't.
Person has?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the dam, the PGE dam. I assume then that the new power generating plant could conceivably qualify for an exemption.
Yes, it could. Yes, it could. And we are examining those types of opportunities.
So if I can follow up on that. So a power generating plant, let's say, over in Umatilla area, I know you're Warm Springs, but they would be exempted from the income taxes associated with that facility, or property taxes, or both?
The way the bill is constructed, it would be, if the tribe levied an equivalent tax, then that would be a credit against the state tax, and that could be an income tax, it could be a property tax, be it rural, real, or personal.
And then all that revenue would go to the, well, they could conceivably still be paying some state income tax.
Yes.
And some local property tax. Follow up, casinos, would they be subject, new casinos, would they be subject to this at all?
This wouldn't have any impact on casinos because those are owned by the tribe. They can't be owned by non-Indians.
They can't be owned.
Cannot
now anyway.
Okay.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any requirement in the dash fours for payment of prevailing wage or local hire?
The tribe is subject to the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act and has to pay wages there. In terms of the prevailing wage rates, if we're engaged in a project that uses federal funds, whether it's highway construction or whatever, then we have to pay those. Otherwise, no.
So, follow up. So, if it was a private enterprise doing it, those prevailing wage requirements would not be placed on?
I don't believe so.
Well, if I might follow up on that, Representative Brown, we are not planning on going out and recruiting businesses that are not going to pay, or at least a good portion of those jobs are not going to pay family wage jobs, family wages, much like in the same that OEDD in their recruitment efforts and working with counties and economic development districts they encourage in their programs businesses that are coming in to, and they look for how many family wage jobs are going to be provided. And we're certainly going to be looking for the same thing.
Other questions?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess one other thought or question. So have you given, I assume you've explored this with the state and local governments, but have you thought about some kind of rebate in to the tribe, rather than this approach? Have you explored some kind of system that the county, local government, and the state would rebate the tribal government a certain amount of money proportional to the value of the asset, and maybe some cost, appropriate cost? I mean, assuming that we want, if you're generating income, you should pay tax to the state of Oregon. We all benefit by being there, but obviously there are costs the tribe incurs by all the services you provide. Would there be a way to come up with a factor to have the state reimburse you from the income taxes generated and from the local property taxes generated? Did you look at it that way or talk to anybody about it? Or is it
we have not more cumbersome.
Anyone like that? My initial reaction is that, one, that we tried to embody the concept that we did not want to make the reservation, for example, a tax haven where they could pay less tax. It ought to be the same. Okay, so that they pay the same amount on or off. So it's not in the rebate. I'm not. Maybe that happens. Maybe it doesn't. Two, sort of using the concept of the enterprise zone. Similar to the state, same types of requirements to qualify for one, but recognizing that it's a unique tribal area. And then three is that the tribal government is, and the tribal council is very jealous of its sovereignty and its authority over the reservation. And the thing that strikes me about that proposal is that it starts to really get us entangled with each other. And so the concept here was, we're not going to change any returns. In essence, there's state tax laws, the same returns and the same audit ability and everything else applies. They simply have a credit, and you're able to check and do the audit as to whether, in fact, it was paid. So it doesn't get us entangled in each other's affairs to a great extent.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you,
Roger. Martin. Roger Martin. Has
I'm Chair and Member of the Committee. My name is Roger Martin. I represent the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla. And although we have just received these amendments, so we haven't had a chance to get specific instructions, I do want to add my support on behalf of the tribe for what's being done here and to point out a couple of broad type things. Number one, it probably, and I've checked with a couple of the other tribal lobbyists in the room, it probably only applies to the Warm Springs and the Umatilla reservations because of the size of those reservations. And I think everybody ought to realize it's probably totally perspective. To the best of my knowledge, every single entity that is of commercial nature on the reservation is owned by the tribes right now, and they don't pay any property tax. Now, there are some opportunities on the Umatilla reservation for private enterprise. Example, the one small grocery store that existed in the little town of Agency, which is the headquarters for the Umatilla tribe, closed and was torn down a few years, within the last year. There are plans for a grocery store to be put in there. And right now the tribe is thinking they'll probably run the grocery store, but here's an opportunity for a private ownership grocery store to go in if there's a way to get reimbursement for the tribe for the services we provide. The fire station for the entire area is 2 blocks from where this grocery store would go in. We supply fire protection to the entire reservation, and in the case of the Umatilla reservation, unlike the Warm Springs, and I wished I had a map to show you, it's a total checkerboard. Every other section is privately owned, and every other section next to it is tribal property. We presently provide fire protection for all of the private parts of the checkerboard. We supply the fire protection for all of these private ownerships that are in there, thanks to a decision by our wonderful federal government in Washington about 130 years ago when they, in my opinion, not anybody else, stole half the reservation through an act of Congress and gave it to people because, unfortunately, whoever signed the original treaty had forgot that there was some darn good wheat land involved in the original reservation, so they wanted to recoup some of that. That's another story altogether. So I want to point out, I think we would probably provide private enterprise some opportunities that they don't now have on the reservation. The one service station on the reservation is tribally owned. The casino, the hotel, the golf course, all those things are presently tribally owned and for that reason not taxed whatsoever. And I know this bill doesn't give any opportunity for us to charge the private ownership properties for the fire and police protection we presently give them. That may be down in the future. But I do think there's an opportunity here, and for those from local government who are in the back of the room envisioning millions of dollars of tax revenues being lost, I would point out that in the case of our tribe, the one energy project now being considered is a joint effort between the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla, the City of Hermiston, and Eugene Water and Electric Board, all of which are public entities, and that is probably not going to pay any property tax anyway because it's all publicly owned. So we would urge you to continue. We'd appreciate it. I think we all have to realize there's a changing nature. For the last century, most of these tribes have gotten lots of federal money through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's what's built a lot of what's there now, the infrastructure. But the federal government is slowly weaning all the tribes off. We are becoming more entrepreneur. We're creating new opportunities, but they're totally tribally owned. And if we want this to be partially private enterprise owned, this would be a good piece of legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2131? Why don't we still need to get the revenue impact statement? There's some work that needs to be done on that amendment, the clarification of which taxes are going to be credited. So we will close the work session on House Bill 2131. And thank you. Open a work session on House Bill 2206.
I think Warm Springs really wants to bring in some private industry.
Madam Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2206, this is just really a cleanup bill from the Department of Revenue. It's clarifying some language to conform with Measure 50 changes in valuation of in the valuation statutes for the ratio study and the tax roll correction statute. So it's just trying to clarify which values are supposed to be used in these statutes. It also clarifies that operating taxes not levy shall be extended on the tax roll and reduced by offsets each year. It replaces some outdated language. The term full true value is replaced with real market value in statutes pertaining to the real and personal property of the United States, which is subject to the contract of sale. And it's replacing full assessed value with real market value for statutes pertaining to the real and personal property of the United States held under lease. So these are just some cleanup type issues. And it's also stipulating that the change property ratio, the average maximum assessed value divided by average real market value, shall not exceed 1. And it applies to tax years beginning July 1st, 2001. There's no revenue impact on this. It's just really a cleanup. It's just kind of clarifying some of these Measure 50 issues and also just implementing into law and the Department of Revenue rule, which is restricting that change property ratio to 1.
We have a long list of people that want to testify. I'm going to start with John Phillips.
Either one, I bet.
Good afternoon again. John Phillips for the record with the Department of Revenue. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As you probably have heard, Measure 50 passed in 1997, was implemented by Senate Bill 1215, which had 253 pages. Several of you were on that committee that passed that bill, and it was a great effort.
Madam Chair, one of us was on that.
One very important person.
That's a debate.
It did amend 50 Oregon revised statutes, and every now and then we run across or dust off a statute we thought we understood, and we reread it, and we see a little variation in the terms that would have been changed had we been aware of it at the time that Senate bill was passed. And so what this bill tries to do is to pick up some of those things that we found that would conform current law to the references to offsets and values that were changed with Measure 50. I can go through this section by section, but if you're inclined to pass it, I'd just as soon do that.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
I move House Bill 2206
to pass. Madam Chair, could I maybe just ask if Representative Shetterly would allow an amendment to his motion that we refer to this on the floor not as the Measure 50 cleanup bill, but as the Shetterly cleanup bill?
Thank you. Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2206 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Okay.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Lynch.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2206, having the required votes or whatever it will say.
It's not constitutional yet.
Here. And, Representative Shetterly will carry the Shetterly plan.
You have to read it.
Huh?
You have to read it.
I think you asked nicely, Mr. Phillips will sit down, go over section by section.
If you're not careful, I will.
Any other business for the good of the order? Adjourned.
Even the patrol.
Yeah.